From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. Now we switch to the science of recycling with Jenny Romer, who, after a decade of research, has found out which parts of our current recycling system work well and which parts don't work well. She's published a new book, Illustrated Guide to Recycling, a great one to have on hand when you find yourself holding something up, looking at it, and asking yourself, can I recycle this? That is the name of Jenny's book. Jenny Romer, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's nice to have you on the program. And let's start with something disturbing. I just want to read a sentence. In your book, 11 million metric tons of plastic waste enter the ocean every year. Plastic will outweigh fish in the ocean by 2050. That's not good.
No, it's not. And that's when I'm an attorney with the Surfrider Foundation, my day job, and with their Plastic Pollution Initiative. And Surfrider looks at plastic pollution from, looks at plastic from the vantage point of plastic in the ocean. So it's what I spend a lot of my time thinking about. And really, one of the focuses for reducing plastic overall is to have less of it, a whole lot less of it, go into our environment.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, I used to work at a plastics factory. I was a mechanic on the machines. I think I lied about my age. You had to be 18 to be a mechanic. I think I was like 16, but it was a good job, and I learned a lot. And we had these big grinders so that when stuff was sent back or it wasn't, the parts weren't just right, we'd grind them up and we'd put them back in the machine and, you know, ejection mold, these different things. And I found it fascinating in your book, as you talked about resins, resin number 6 versus resin number 2 versus 1 versus 5. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. When you look at the bottom of a plastic container, most of them have a tracing arrow symbol and a number in the middle. That number is a resin code. The lower resin numbers tend to be more recyclable, meaning that they have a market demand, like someone actually wants to buy them, versus the higher numbers. So the number 1 and number 2 bottles and jugs, those are the most valuable plastics on the market, and those tend to be the water bottles and milk jugs. And the lower value stuff, like number 6 is they make party cups out of those. Pretty much no one wants to buy them to recycle in the U.S.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Jenny Romer. She has written a new book called Can I Recycle This? She's also an attorney with the Surfrider Foundation. And Jenny, I just wanted to ask you quickly about that. I mean, you know, a lot of your focus is on plastics. It's also on helping communities create legislation that will, you know, put in place less plastic use. And something that we did in Park City here, which was pretty difficult because Utah is not a home rule state, and this wasn't an incredibly popular bit of legislation, but we got it passed, and that was to do away with single-use plastic bags just within city limits. So I wanted to get your take on that versus, you know, in this time of sort of examining this new new rule here in Park City, people were saying, well, paper is worse and cotton bags are even worse than that. What is your take?
Well, that's something I've been thinking about for over a decade. I was in San Francisco back when San Francisco passed its initial law, the bag ban there, and I saw the plastics industry had really gotten, was represented in San Francisco then and pushing back, and I saw a PowerPoint presentation that they were willing to spend $700,000 in less than a year on pushing back on local plastics policies, because they saw it as a gateway to regulating other types of plastic. And so, you know, I saw that, and that really inspired me to start working on it. Found my own website, plasticbaglaws.org. And with that, you know, we saw that that there were a lot of questions about, could, if you put a plastic bag law in place, what happens? And so I've spent a lot of time looking at the effectiveness. And I found that having a fee, not just a ban, but also having a fee on the alternatives is really the best way to move forward. And that way people really respond and bring their own bags rather than getting kind of whatever the other thing is that's available for free. And so we've seen that especially if there's a fee in place or if there's a lot of restrictions on what is available, then people really bring their own bags. And so I keep track of all of the effectiveness studies in the U.S. and all of them say that if you have that fee in place, people will start bringing their own bags. Mm-hmm. But now we're talking, going beyond bags and really looking at things like banning foam foodware, straws upon request. Washington State just passed a policy that requires restaurants to not give utensils unless customers ask for them, because there are so many non-recyclable plastic utensils being used, especially during the pandemic.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's a whole other world to explore. We've all, you know, eaten to go and curbside pickup during the pandemic. And I'm wondering if you could address, that was one of my questions. Are any of those plastic forks and spoons, the cutlery they give you, recyclable at all? You're saying a lot of them aren't. How do you know?
Yeah, I would say none of them really are. My book looks at just kind of three steps to whether something is truly recyclable. One is whether it's collected in the majority of jurisdictions. Second is whether it can be sorted in existing sorting machinery. And the third is whether there's an end market for it, meaning somebody wants to buy it. And there are two problems with utensils. Some jurisdictions will accept them kind of just because some jurisdictions will accept any plastic and they'll kind of sort it through on their side because they think they'll get the greatest volume that way. But with those utensils, most of them will not be able to make it through recycling sorting machinery. There are a lot of cracks in the machinery that they'll fall through. They're kind of awkwardly shaped. And then even if they do happen to make it through, they're generally made out of a resin, usually number 6, that no one wants to buy. So after all that work, they're going to end up going to a landfill or incineration anyway. But that is, the utensils are something that should be pretty easily avoidable. Because a lot of the time people are at home or somewhere where they could have their own utensils. And so just being a little bit more diligent about saying, no, I don't need those. And the laws that are, like Washington State just adopted, make it more clear that restaurants shouldn't be providing them if you don't want them. And ultimately that saves restaurants money as well, mm-hmm. because they're not having to give this thing away for free anymore.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, it's a takeout delivery world. And maybe what they should do is have some sort of legislation that says you can't do takeout or delivery. And if you want utensils, you have to request them. And, you know, that sort
of thing. That's what the Washington law does essentially, is just saying, you know, you can still have them, but you just need to request it rather than having it be the default. And kind of in our culture, it's become the default that the restaurants want to be nice and give you the utensils, but really it ultimately costs the money, and it means a whole lot more utensils that are in our environment.
So you've said this a number of times, recycling is a commodity market. So back to those milk jugs, which are number 2 resin, you can get about $1,000 a ton for them. And back to these plastic utensils, you kind of have to pay people to take them if you have enough of them. But one of the things that you said, just going back to the milk jug for a minute, is when you put a milk jug in recycling, put the cap back on it, because if the cap is separate, it'll probably fall through the cracks or it won't be sorted, that sort of thing. So, you know, I mean, you think about all the caps on gallon milk jugs over a period of time. It's a lot of plastic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speaking of plastic in the ocean in particular, those caps are made out of a different type of plastic than the jug itself. And those caps are made out of a plastic that isn't very dense. So in water, it floats. And so one thing that we've seen in the ocean is that we see the accumulations of plastic, they call gyres, or in gyres. And they and those tend to be a lot of caps, because those caps are made out of polypropylene that float. So that should be added another reason to make sure that you're recycling your caps properly so that they don't end up floating in the ocean. But some people think, oh, I don't know what's going to happen to them. I'll just leave them off and throw them in the bin. But they're going to be too small. Generally, things that are about two inches by 2 inches or less aren't going to make it through most machinery and are just going to end up, you know, either kind of on the floor of a recycling facility somewhere, or we're going to landfill or incineration.
Or in the ocean.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm really glad you made this distinction, Jenny, because here in Park City, we have a recycle center, and when you take your plastics there, they want you to separate the caps from the, you know, the container, which makes sense. Then all the caps are together and they do whatever they do with the caps. However, as taxpayers, we also have curbside recycling for most things. But because I know at the recycle center you have to separate the caps, I have been separating the caps in my curbside, and I'm doing wrong. Another thing I'm doing wrong, and this is, well, so you stop at your local coffee shop, and since the pandemic, you haven't been able to bring in your own coffee cup. You have to use their paper cup. Hopefully it's paper and not styrofoam. Most places now have paper, but I didn't know the lid wasn't recyclable because it's that, again, is it that number six plastic?
Yeah, it's usually number six.
Okay, and then the reason that the cup itself, I thought it wasn't recyclable, was because it was dirty with coffee, and so I would wash it out just with a little water, throw it in the recycling, but tell us why it's not recyclable.
Yeah, so coffee cups are another, you know, good thing to avoid if you can. And I know during the pandemic, hopefully we'll see a lot less restrictions that have been put in place. We'll see them taken away as far as bringing reusables in most places. Those have been removed now. So bring your own cup if you can. But the really big reason behind it is that not only is that lid not really recyclable because it's made out of a non-recyclable resin, but the cup itself, it's paper, but it's made out of really short fiber paper. And so in order for paper to really be recycled at a paper recycling mill, the long fibers are what get caught on the screens and made into new paper. And the short fibers just kind of float through. It's really not going to be turned into another cup, unfortunately. Things like paper bags and cardboard boxes, those have long fibers, and those are going to be made into new paper. But things with short fibers, like coffee cups, tissue paper, toilet paper, well, not that you'd really want to put your toilet paper in the recycling, but those are short fibers.
Jenny, what's the one, maybe the second or third misconception that you believe people across the country have about recycling?
The plastics industry spend a whole lot of money on making us feel good about recycling. So I think that people will, you know, if they're on the fence, they'll go ahead and put things in the recycling, or even put things that your town tells you not to put in. People will still put it in anyway because we've been taught to feel so good about recycling. And so that's something that it's hard to push back on. And making sure that we're concentrating not just on recycling, but on reduction and reuse. That's really much better for the environment. And so I work on policies pushing towards reduction and reuse as well. And, you know, we want to make recycling effective, but also trying to put policies in place that encourage more reuse and refill systems.
Jenny, our relationship with China has changed in many ways. Politically, economically, I mean, all sorts of different ways. And one of the ways that it's changed is in recycling. Maybe you can give us a brief history of what we were doing like up to 20 years ago with China and what's going on right now.
Sure, yeah. So for a long time, we were sending our low-value plastic to China, in part because the shipping was really inexpensive. Because of the trade deficit, we were spending a lot of money on Chinese goods, but then those shipping containers were going back to China empty. So there was an opportunity to put a lot of our low-value plastic waste in those containers, not pay very much for shipping, and then it was going to China where there was an informal recycling sector that the government was encouraging, where family farms were being turned into recycling facilities. And that wasn't necessarily a good thing because there are a lot of environmental and labor and health laws that were not being enforced. So you saw people processing all of the recyclables, you know, without wearing any kind of protective clothing, and if some kind of cherry picking for the good stuff and dumping the rest in the environment and a lot of the time burning it. So that's really not what we think of when we think of recycling. And, you know, a few years ago, China stopped taking our low value plastics. And that really became much more of a discussion of what was happening to it in the first place. For so long, we really didn't know or didn't think about what was happening. And now that's really become part of the discussion. So I think that's a good thing. I think that we should have more of an emphasis on processing our own plastics to domestically. And that way we know what's happening. And we can, you know, if the stuff isn't able to really be recycled, then looking at having more sustainable, more recyclable materials being used in the first place and creating green jobs.
We're speaking with Jenny Romer. Her book is Can I Recycle This? A Guide to Better Recycling and How to Reduce Single-Use Plastics. I wanted to ask you if you're seeing a proliferation of these stores that have bulk, you know, laundry soap and dish soap and shampoo. It seems as though, even though I'll buy my, you know, laundry soap at Costco, so it's big and it seems to last, you know, it should last for years, it looks like, but it lasts for a couple months. And then you're throwing that big, thick plastic into the recycle bin. I never feel good about that. Are you seeing more of this sort of thing happening where you just take in your container and refill it?
Yeah, I highlight one place in the book that Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco, which is kind of the ultimate in all of that. You can get 6 different types of homemade pesto and bring your own container for it, or a lot of different types of lotions and shampoos. But we are seeing smaller places pop up in a lot of cities. But I would like to see beyond that, I'd like to see incentives for big business, for consumer packaged goods companies to make that available for their products. Because people have a lot of brand loyalty. They want it to be easy. And so making that a whole lot easier so that people don't have to go too far out of their way to, you know, use their reusable containers, and they can get the brands that they want. So I think it's a trend, but I want to see it brought to a whole other level. And so I'm working on what we call extended producer responsibility policies. Those make manufacturers responsible for the cost of recycling and waste disposal. But I also want to see, as part of that, I want to see more incentives for refill and reuse to happen in a real way.
Absolutely. Well, for our listeners, we don't have that sort of place here in Park City, but there is one of these stores in Salt Lake City. I haven't been there. Some friends have refilled a few of my bottles that I've sent with them, and I'm looking it up. Someone can text me if they know what it's called, but I have found one called Hello Bulk Markets. So that could be it. Looks like it's on 5th West and 355 North in Salt Lake City. That may or may not be the place. But wanted to ask you about this page, and compliment you on your book because it's illustrated by Christy Young. It's very well illustrated in a fun, very appealing way. But you also have so much information, and not just cursory information. I think even the executive director of our Recycle Center could learn a lot from this book. You talk about resource extraction, plastic, aluminum, paper, and glass. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. I wanted to have appeal to a wide audience. Like you said, people who just want to learn a little bit more about what they should put in their bins and what happens, and also people that have been in the industry for a while. So I think the illustrations by Christy Young, they're beautiful watercolors. They really help get my ideas across. And, you know, I get into the details of resin coats, but, you know, you can also just look at the beautiful pictures if that's what you want to do. But as far as...
Do we have
Did
you?
I lose you there?
Well, we've got you now. Lost you for a moment.
Okay.
I think
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
Yeah, I think it was somebody from Extended Producer Liability that was trying to block this call.
that must be it. I will say that one other...
Well,
I just wanted to say it from a bigger perspective. I've been working on these extended producer responsibility laws, but then also there's a federal bill called the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act that looks at everything that I talk about in my book, from extraction to production to recycling to waste disposal, and really looks at it. At the whole issue in an all-encompassing way, and has a path forward to how to address single-use plastic and improve recycling. Oh, and I think I didn't address your question about extraction. Sorry, I look at extraction in the book because we want to look at what we're avoiding if we're recycling. So you're avoiding the process of extracting the raw materials. So the aluminum, the plastic, the wood, the paper, which is a lot of the time wood. And so we look at the harms that are caused by that, particularly with aluminum. Bauxite mining is one of the most harmful things that you extract because of the environmental and the human impacts. So thinking about those reasons why you should be recycling in the first place, I think is really important.
So, Jenny, let's go back to extended producer liability. I have a question. Are we asking the producer, for an example, the injection molding company that I used to work for, to pay? Or are we asking the big business, the one that's, let's say it's Procter & Gamble, that's filling these things with laundry detergent? Who's paying?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's kind of a hierarchy of someone will have to pay. It's generally the manufacturers, but that really comes down to the brands. So we really want to motivate the brands like like Procter & Gamble to make their materials, make their packaging out of materials that are really recyclable in the first place. Because right now it's not fair that it's the local jurisdictions that are having to pay for the products or the packaging to be incinerated or landfilled, because those brands really have no incentive once it leaves their hands. And so shifting that incentive to say, you know, you have to pay for the cost of recycling, and if that happens, you know, they're going to make their packaging out of materials like the HDPE jugs that have a value, rather than out of that really low value stuff. And for them, it's really a very small difference in the cost at the front end to really be able to have a recyclable packaging at the back end.
Okay. All right. Now, back to China. We used to have this situation where we sent them the plastic, all the plastic in these container ships that were of low value, and then we would fill those containers with stuff that we're getting from China. It's not a trade balance. It's a very trade not balance, because we import a lot more than we export. Have we been able to capitalize on that now that we've changed things? Looks like we're almost out of time, actually. I think that might be a long answer, we do want to thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio. And this is Jenny Romer. Can I Recycle This is the name of the book. And we thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Yeah, great conversation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jenny.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.